Curious Republic of Gondor by Mark Twain. The Curious Republic of Gondor and Other Whimsical Sketches. Note: most of the sketches in this volume were taken from a series the author wrote for The Galaxy from May 1870 to April 1871. The rest appeared in the Buffalo Express. Table of Contents: The Curious Republic of Gondor, a memory introductory to Emeranda. About smells: a couple of sad experiences. Dan Murphy, The Ornament in A. D.D. 1870. Curious relic for sailor, reminiscence of the back settlements, a royal compliment, the approaching epidemic, the tone imparting committee, our precious lunatic, the European war, the wild man interviewed, last words of great men. The Curious Republic of Gondor. As soon as I had learned to speak the language a little, I became greatly interested in the people and the system of government. I found that the nation had at first tried universal suffrage, pure and simple, but had thrown that form aside, because the result was not satisfactory. It had seemed to deliver all power into the hands of the ignorant and non-tax-paying classes, and of a necessity the responsible offices were filled from these classes also. A remedy was sought. The people believed they had found it, not in the destruction of universal suffrage, but in the enlargement of it. It was an odd idea, and ingenious. You must understand, the Constitution gave every man a vote, therefore that vote was a vested right, and could not be taken away. But the Constitution did not say that certain individuals might not be given 2 votes, or 10. So an amendatory clause was inserted in a quiet way, a clause which authorized the enlargement of the suffrage in certain cases, to be specified by statute. To offer to limit the suffrage might have made instant trouble, the offer to enlarge it had a pleasant aspect. But of course the newspapers soon began to suspect, and then out they came. It was found, however, that for once and for the first time in the history of the Republic, property, character, and intellect were able to wield a political influence. For once, money, virtue, and intelligence took a vital and a united interest in a political question. For once these powers went to the primaries in strong force. For once the best men in the nation were put forward as candidates for that parliament whose business it should be, to enlarge the suffrage. The weightiest half of the press quickly joined forces with the new movement, and left the other half to rail about the proposed destruction of the liberties of the bottom layer of society, the hitherto governing class of the community. The victory was complete. The new law was framed and passed. Under it every citizen, howsoever poor or ignorant, possessed 1 vote, so universal suffrage still reigned. But if a man possessed a good common school education and no money, he had 2 votes. A high school education gave him 4. If he had property likewise, to the value of 3,000 sacos, apostrophe, he wielded 1 more vote. For every 50,000 sacos a man added to his property, he was entitled to another vote. A university education entitled a man to 9 votes, even though he owned no property. Therefore, learning being more prevalent, and more easily acquired than riches, educated men became a wholesome check upon wealthy men, since they could outvote them. Learning goes usually with uprightness, broad views, and humanity. So the learned voters, possessing the balance of power, became the vigilant and efficient protectors of the great lower rank of society. And now a curious thing developed itself, a sort of emulation, whose object was voting power. Whereas formerly a man was honored only according to the amount of money he possessed, his grandeur was measured now by the number of votes he wielded. A man with only 1 vote was conspicuously respectful to his neighbor who possessed 3. And if he was a man above the commonplace, he was as conspicuously energetic in his determination to acquire 3 for himself. This spirit of emulation invaded all ranks. Votes based upon capital were commonly called mortal votes, because they could be lost, Those based upon learning were called mortal, because they were permanent, and because of their customarily imperishable character they were naturally more valued than the other sort. I say customarily for the reason that these votes were not absolutely imperishable, since insanity could suspend them. Under this system, gambling and speculation almost ceased in the Republic. A man honored as the possessor of great voting power could not afford to risk the loss of it upon a doubtful chance. It was curious to observe the manners and customs which the enlargement plan produced. Walking the street with a friend one day, he delivered a careless bow to a passerby, and then remarked that that person possessed only one vote, and would probably never earn another. He was more respectful to the next acquaintance he met. He explained that this salute was a four-vote bow. I tried to verge the importance of the people he accosted after that by the nature of his bows, but my success was only partial because of the somewhat greater homage paid to the immortals than to the mortals. My friend explained. He said there was no law to regulate this thing except that most powerful of all laws, custom. Custom had created these varying bows, and in time they had become easy and natural. At this moment he delivered himself of a very profound salute, and then said, "Now there's a man who began life as a shoemaker's apprentice, and without education. Now he swings 22 mortal votes and 2 immortal ones. He expects to pass a high school examination this year, and climb a couple of votes higher among the immortals. Mighty valuable citizen." By and by my friend met a venerable personage, and not only made him a most elaborate bow, but also took off his hat. I took off mine too, with a mysterious awe. I was beginning to be infected. What grandee is that? That is our most illustrious astronomer. He hasn't any money, but is fearfully learned. 9 immortals is his political weight. He would swing 150 votes, if our system were perfect. Is there any altitude of mere moneyed grandeur that you take off your hat to? No. 9 immortal votes is the only power we uncover for that is, in civil life. Very great officials receive that mark of homage, of course. It was common to hear people admiringly mention men who had begun life on the lower levels, and in time achieved great voting power. It was also common to hear youths planning a future of ever so many votes for themselves. I heard shrewd mamas speak of certain young men as good catches, because they possessed such and such a number of votes. I knew of more than one case, where an heiress was married to a youngster who had but one vote, the argument being that he was gifted with such excellent parts, that in time he would acquire a good voting strength, and perhaps in the long run be able to outvote his wife, if he had luck. Competitive examinations were the rule and in all official grades. I remarked that the questions asked the candidates were wild, intricate, and often required a sort of knowledge not needed in the office sought. "Can a fool or an ignoramus answer them?" asked the person I was talking with. "Certainly not." "Well, you will not find any fools or ignoramuses among our officials." I felt rather cornered, but made shift to say, "But these questions cover a good deal more ground than is necessary." "No matter. If candidates can answer these, it is tolerably fair evidence that they can answer nearly any other question you choose to ask them." There were some things in Gonder which one could not shut his eyes to. One was that ignorance and incompetence had no place in the government. Brains and property managed the state. A candidate for office must have marked ability, education, and high character, or he stood no sort of chance of election. If a hod carrier possessed these, he could succeed. But the mere fact that he was a hod carrier could not elect him, as in previous times. It was now a very great honor to be in the parliament or in office. Under the old system, such distinction had only brought suspicion upon a man, and made him a helpless mark for newspaper contempt and scurrility. Officials did not need to steal now, their salaries being vast in comparison with the pittances paid in the days when parliaments were created by hod carriers, who viewed official salaries from a hog-carrying point of view, and compelled that view to be respected by their obsequious servants. Justice was wisely and rigidly administered. For a judge, after once reaching his place through the specified line of promotions, was a permanency during good behavior. He was not obliged to modify his judgments according to the effect they might have upon the temper of a reigning political party. The country was mainly governed by a ministry which went out with the administration that created it. This was also the case with the chiefs of the great departments. Minor officials ascended to their several positions through well-earned promotions, and not by a jump from gin mills, or the needy families and friends of members of parliament. Good behavior measured their terms of office. The head of the governments, the Grand Caliph, was elected for a term of 20 years. I questioned the wisdom of this. I was answered that he could do no harm, since the ministry and the parliament governed the land, and he was liable to impeachment for misconduct. This great office had twice been ably filled by women, women as aptly fitted for it as some of the sceptered queens of history. Members of the cabinet, under many administrations, had been women. I found that the pardoning power was lodged in a court of pardons, consisting of several great judges. Under the old regime, this important power was vested in a single official, and he usually took care to have a general jail delivery in time for the next election. I inquired about public schools. There were plenty of them, and of free colleges too. I inquired about compulsory education. This was received with a smile, and the remark, "When a man's child is able to make himself powerful and honored according to the amount of education he acquires, don't you suppose that that parent will apply the compulsion himself? Our free schools and free colleges require no law to fill them." There was a loving pride of country about this person's way of speaking which annoyed me. I had long been unused to the sound of it in my own. The Gonder national airs were forever dinning in my ears. Therefore I was glad to leave that country and come back to my dear native land, where one never hears that sort of music. A memory, when I say that I never knew my austere father to be enamored of but one poem in all the long half-century that he lived, persons who knew him will easily believe me. When I say that I have never composed but one poem in all the long third of a century that I have lived, persons who know me will be sincerely grateful. And finally, when I say that the poem which I composed was not the one which my father was enamored of, persons who may have known us both will not need to have this truth shot into them with a mountain howitzer before they can receive it. My father and I were always on the most distant terms, when I was a boy, a sort of armed neutrality, so to speak. At irregular intervals this neutrality was broken, and suffering ensued. But I will be candid enough to say that the breaking and the suffering were always divided up with strict impartiality between us, which is to say, my father did the breaking, and I did the suffering. As a general thing I was a backward, cautious, an adventurous boy, but I once jumped off a two-story table, another time I gave an elephant a lug of tobacco, and retired without waiting for an answer, and still another time I pretended to be talking in my sleep, and got off a portion of a very wretched original conundrum in the hearing of my father. Let us not pry into the result, it was of no consequence to anyone but me. But the poem I have referred to as attracting my father's attention and achieving his favor was Iaatha. Some man who courted a sudden and awful death presented him an early copy, and I never lost faith in my own senses until I saw him sit down and go to reading it in cold blood, saw him open the book, and heard him read these following lines, with the same inflectionless judicial frigidity with which he always read his charge to the jury, or administered an oath to a witness. Take your bow, O Iaatha, take your arrows, jasper-headed. Take your war club, Pug-a-gun, and your mittens, Minjikawan, and your birch canoe for sailing, and the oil of Mishnama. Presently my father took out of his breast pocket an imposing guaranty deed, and fixed his eyes upon it, and dropped into meditation. I knew what it was. A Texan lady and gentleman had given my half-brother, Orrin Johnson, a handsome property in a town in the north, in gratitude to him for having saved their lives by an act of brilliant heroism. By and by my father looked towards me and sighed. Then he said, "If I had such a son as this poet, here were a subject worthier than the traditions of these Indians. If you please, sir, where? In this deed." "Yes, in this very deed," said my father, throwing it on the table. "There is more poetry, more romance, more sublimity, more splendid imagery hidden away in that homely document than could be found in all the traditions of all the savages that live." "Indeed, sir? Could I get it out, sir? Could I compose the poem, sir, do you think?" "You?" I wilted. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.